You are listening to Badass in Heels, a podcast for everyone who's ever wondered what it's like to be a woman in the FBI. And now your host, retired supervisory special agent, Nancy Aguilar.
Hi, I'm Nancy. Welcome to Badass in Heels. You are listening to episode 20. With me today is Jennifer Cormack, a retired FBI supervisory special agent with 20 years of law enforcement experience. Prior to being in the FBI, Jen was with the U.S. Army for almost 6 years, where she was an Arabic linguist and an engineer officer. Throughout her tenure with the FBI, she mainly worked counterterrorism matters. She was also in the hazmat unit and was an LNO for CENTCOM, the U.S. Central Command, and for SOXINT, Special Operations Command Central. Jen, welcome to Badass in Heels.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so honored to be here.
I'm so excited and looking forward to our conversation. You have an amazing resume, a lot of experience in the Bureau, and we have some things in common. As I was looking at your bio, right, you also support ECTAP, Empower, the Department of State, Department of Justice program, which of course empowers women, police women globally. And I was very impressed by your work that you do post-retirement with
Skull Games.
Yes. So I'm sure it's going to be a fascinating episode, and I'm truly excited about having you on. Before we start talking about your career and your post-career efforts, let's get to know you a little bit better. I know you speak Arabic, but what can you tell us about yourself?
Okay, well, I was born in Kentucky, just, you know, in Frankfort, small town, Kentucky. And when I was about 7 or 8, we moved to Connecticut, but my mom got remarried, and I was up there until about 9th grade. Then we moved to Florida and Sarasota. That's kind of why I consider Florida my home now. And then went to Florida State for college. And then I studied, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I really had no direction with my life at that point, but I knew that I loved photography. So the only way I could take photo classes was to be an art major at Florida State University at that time. So I decided to be an art major, and I focused in photography, and I got a Bachelor of Fine Arts in studio art. And then afterwards I graduated, I was taking school pictures, wedding photos, little stints here and there, but it really wasn't fulfilling. I felt like I didn't want to do that the rest of my life. The type of photography I imagined was me, like Ansel Adams, climbing, you know, the mountains and being out there and taking beautiful black and white photos. But they really didn't teach you how to market yourself back then at college. So every day, though, on my way to my work, I pass by this series of recruiter stations. They're all in a row. And I just really, I don't know, I still don't know exactly why I joined, but I felt compelled to go in and talk to a recruiter. I did talk to the Air Force and then the Army, and I decided to go with the Army after talking to them. I was thinking back why I might wanted to have joined, and I think back to elementary school, there was one lady there who was a school nurse, and for some reason, I didn't even cross my mind until recently, she was the one they had teach us how to march for Memorial Day parade. And when I'm thinking about that now, I'm like, why would they have the school nurse teach us how to march in the Memorial Day parade, unless she happened to have been a veteran herself, and she probably, you know, was either in the Korean War or Vietnam War. So I think early on, I was instilled with a sense of patriotism, and I would like to think I was influenced by her. My dad was also in the ROTC when he was in college, but he didn't ever serve on active duty. So he was always patriotic too. So about a year after I graduated college, I joined the Army. I enlisted instead of going in as an officer. And it was there, because I did really well on the Defense Language Aptitude Battery test, that they placed me in Arabic at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey. I didn't know it all. I didn't know it at all before. I didn't even know anybody that spoke Arabic prior to that point.
Wow. So going back to your childhood, right, you moved a lot.
Yes.
Was there a period, I mean, you're as a child, you're going through different changes, right? Was there a period where you were like, I'm done moving?
Of course, each time I really didn't want to move. First from Kentucky to Connecticut, that was pretty far, and all my family was in Kentucky. Yeah. But I made good friends, you know, pretty much went through first grade through ninth grade. I was on the swim team, you know, did pretty well in Connecticut. And then I didn't want to move from Connecticut to Florida. My parents bought a company. My mom and stepdad bought a door and window company.
Okay.
Down in the Sarasota area.
It's a beautiful place there.
Yeah, I think though, I think I counted, I lived in 15 different states between childhood, the military, and the bureau. Mm. And I seem to average every 5 to 6 or 7 years. I think I'm going on the longest stretch here in Tampa.
And also, I'm sure with each move, you know, you become more adaptable, more resilient. And of course, it's tough always to have to move. But I think it exposes us to just different things, different people, moving from little cities to big cities. And now, of course, you're still in Florida, which you have the ocean. And we were just talking about the weather. Well, here in Virginia, it's cold. You have the benefit of, for the moment, not being too hot, right? But pleasant.
Yeah, it's very nice here right now in Florida.
So you talked about walking into the recruiter's office, and I was very surprised to hear, you know, when you said you went to both the Army and the Air Force. And I've heard that the Air Force is more, it's a better place for women. So why did you choose, I might be completely wrong, right? But that's what I heard. So why did you choose the Army versus the Air Force?
I felt like I could do more in the Army than what the Air Force was offering me. Although, I mean, I do have to say they do have better facilities in the Army, except for when we were all in Monterey all together. It's a combined base there. But everywhere else I've been, the Air Force definitely has better quality of life, I guess, but I didn't want it necessarily to be easy. I don't know, Army's the one I chose.
So you had the benefit of going to Monterey, right, and studying Arabic, which I'm sure was high in demand back in the day. I mean, it still is. But when things were starting up, right, that was very convenient for you to already have that language. Like when terrorism kind of hit here in the United States and with the Army, did you deploy abroad to utilize the language?
No, so I entered Monterey about 1996, and the reason they were having a lot of people go through Arabic was they didn't have enough during the first Gulf War, mm-hmm. So they were trying to prepare. So the whole training took about 63 weeks, and then there was more training to learn your actual job, which for me was signals intelligence, and then I got stationed at Fort Bragg. I did travel to Jordan for about 6 weeks to for some language immersion training.
Wonderful.
And then I decided to go to officer candidate school, and they ended up branching me engineer. So I went from learning Arabic to learning engineering, which was also not something I'd ever done before. But they told me at the time they had just opened engineering to women, and they needed more women in that branch. So that's kind of how I ended up there. When I got out of the military, it was June 2001, and I was still in the National Guard. So nobody expected 9/11 to come, right? Mm-hmm. Or we might have stayed in, but my ex-husband and I weren't stationed together. He was also in the military. We got married in August. 9/11 happened. The unit did call us all in, and my commander was like, "You speak Arabic, right?" And I was like, "Well, you branched me engineer, so I'm a little rusty." But he said they're forming this thing called the Joint Terrorism Task Force here in Oregon, and they're looking for some help with interviewing some of the Arabs in town. Well, you just go to the meeting and see if anybody needs help. So I went to this, I think it was in Salem, Oregon, at the Capitol. And I was like, I know some Arabic. If anybody needs anything, I didn't know where I really fit in at that point. But a Secret Service agent called me to go with him to interview somebody that was incarcerated at the moment they were interested in. And then an FBI agent called me also and to go with him on an interview. And both of them on the drive there heavily recruited me to join the Bureau. And I was like, me? You know, I had always made, I thought about police, you know, being a police woman when I was a kid. I was always like, cops and robbers, I was always the cop, right? But I really never pursued that. And it seemed, I was like, okay, you know, I'm like, I would really, really like that. I mean, Silence of the Lambs wasn't, had come out not too long before that. You know, maybe mm-hmm. I was in middle or high school when that came out. And that was always seemed inspiring and cool to me. So I ended up applying to both the Secret Service and the Bureau. And I was really in the same process. Like the timeline was going very quickly with both. I passed the test, I did the interviews, physical fitness. And then I decided the Bureau came up with the polygraph sooner. And the more I learned about the two, the more I was leaning toward the Bureau because they had more options as far as, you know, investigative subjects that they did, you know, types of investigations, I should say. And the pay grade actually started a little higher in the Bureau. So I ended up, since I passed everything on both, I chose to go with the FBI. I don't know if I was lucky or unlucky, but I had my polygraph and then I had my physical fitness test that same day.
Wow.
It was like kind of a big day. And I was in the academy no less than 6 months after I applied. So wow. By June 2002, I was in the academy.
My goodness. Wow. It seems like you walking, you know, into that recruitment office and then picking the army was highly propitious for where life was going to take you, right? Because
definitely.
It was just like preparing you for what's to come without you even knowing where you're going. Yeah.
Exactly. I do look at that as, I feel like my path was laid out for me in that way. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't expecting it. I didn't know where it was going to take me at that time. And I even look back, my mom moved recently again, and she recently gave me some letters I had written to her while I was in basic training and wow. to my grandmother as well. And I was like, I'm going to go to Arabic school. You know, I'm pretty tired. The work here is pretty hard. And in basic training, I don't know how it's going to be. I don't know where it's going to take me. I had a lot of questions then. And I mean, you really couldn't have told me then where it would be today. But I was kind of along for the ride, trying to listen to the unsaid directions, you know, kind of life was throwing at me. And somebody told me, you know, learning Arabic and learning the SATS keyboard, which is how to type on the, you know, the American keyboard in the Arabic sounds, that would take me places. And I was like, okay.
Yeah, definitely. Do you still speak Arabic?
I try, you know, I do use my Duolingo every day and worked on something else with ISITAP that had to do where the class was in Arabic language. And I listened in and I was able to pick up because it was translated from English to Arabic simultaneously. So I think I was able to pick up on a lot of that. And in the Bureau, too, they were pretty good about people who had languages who wanted more training in that language. So over the years, I did take some refresher classes. And they even started offering like some language pay if you tested at a certain score and everything to encourage people to keep up with their languages.
Yeah, I remember that, right? The language incentives. That's that's phenomenal that you keep up with it. I need to. I've forgotten it. I'll speak it, but I remember I could still 4 years ago, maybe not 5 years ago, you know, still go to Dubai and kind of talk about my cases in Arabic. Now I'm like, Dakika. In which language is in my, I can't anymore. I need to get back on it. And I did love the sound of it, the music.
It's a beautiful language, really. I mean, the way it's structured and the way it flows. When I hear it, I'm like, just sounds nice to me, you know.
Yeah. No, and it's so great that the Bureau, you know, continue to offer the opportunity for you to refresh it, enhance it, and that you still keep it up. That's just pretty amazing. And you're still using it when you go and support ECTAP, right? So right. Let's go back to the academy, right? So you've done basic training, you've done officer's school, and now you're in Quantico in 2002. How do you feel having gone through the Army prepared you for the FBI Academy?
I think I was really prepared for the FBI Academy. In fact, I was having gone through a lot of the training. I mean, I was in training for a long time, and it was school to school. Officer candidate school was very hard. Because I felt like it was maybe 4 months of hazing. I know it wasn't like that for everyone because the other company was treated like gentlemen and ladies, and we were being yelled at and smoked all the time, having to do physical training. And so I was really thinking that maybe the FBI Academy was going to be something similar to a military school where, you know, I have to roll my underwear a certain way and line it up in the drawers and have people measure and throw around my bed if it wasn't made properly. And when I got there and realized nobody even really looked in my room to see if my bed was made, I was just so happy.
The little things.
And physically, I was still in really good shape because I had remained in the guard and we still needed to do the fitness test. So I was really only 1 year from leaving active duty till the time I was in the Bureau. The one thing that I did wasn't that great at was the pull-ups, but I don't think they have those anymore. We had to do the modified pull-up, but I did work on that. And they give you plenty of time to train at Quantico. I used to go with a little group early in the morning. Some people preferred the afternoon, but it wasn't like we had to go to formation and train like in the military. And then we had hand-to-hand combat kind of training, drills, and the FBI Academy. Probably the most challenging was the schoolwork, legal, you know, learning about the laws and regulations. But for me, I felt like as long as I listened in class and studied a little bit, I was well prepared for the tests that they had.
Yeah. Yeah, I imagine. Maybe I should have asked you if the FBI was ready for you. So you graduate Quantico, and what is your first office?
So my first office was Boston. I think it was number 9 on my list, but they specifically requested an Arabic linguist, an agent that had Arabic background. I was hoping to go back to Portland because I hadn't lived there for very long, you know, so it was like another move across country. But I really liked the Boston office. There was a lot of new agents there at the time. And Boston was still kind of reeling from 9/11 because some of the hijackers had lived there and come from that airport. I was assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force from the get-go.
So hit the ground running, get to work. And I'm sure you were, like you just said, they wanted somebody who spoke Arabic. So how busy did they keep you?
I was pretty busy, although I did get some cases that, like, I don't know if they realize that the people don't speak Arabic. And but it was okay. Right about that same time, they were hiring a bunch of linguists. And I think it was always better to have a native speaker on things that you need translated. But for me, it helped too. Like when we had to interview all the Iraqis after the 2003, war started back up in Iraq. It would help with icebreakers. Maybe they didn't know English so much, you know, between my Arabic and their broken English, we would get through an interview together. So I think, and then knowing the culture and understanding, you know, the religion and that part of the world really helped, because to make a connection and help people feel more comfortable, because the bureau can be scary if they're going to come to your door and maybe talk to you about terrorism, right?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it was extremely useful for me, you know, in the late 2000s. So I'm sure for you, it was very welcomed. And it must have been also different to have you as a woman, a fresh face, you know, friendly, approachable, and you speak Arabic. So easier to build rapport and do what you got to do.
Yeah, they're always surprised, you know, especially if it was a man. They're like, you know, you're my sister, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
You get them to open up, I think.
Yeah, I really think that just a few words really help, even if you don't learn the whole language. Mm-hmm. I think in any language, if you can learn some greetings, it'll really do a lot to make people feel more comfortable if you're speaking to someone from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's so important, you mentioned it, to know, even if it's just a little bit about their culture, their religion, and you kind of know about what could be misconstrued, right? Because our culture is different. So kind of learn those sensitivities, especially in law enforcement, I think are crucial for communication. Yeah.
It's so important to build the trust, because you don't want to insult somebody right off the bat by, like, you know, sticking the bottom of your shoe toward them or shaking their hand, you know, if they don't really want their hand to be shaken and that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So how long were you in Boston, the JTTF?
So I was there until about mid-2005. At that time, I had my daughter, and my ex-husband had gotten a job in Rochester, New York. And so he really wanted to move there. So I actually took a leave of absence from the Bureau at that time. First, I had gone part-time, which is a great program they have for moms. If you don't know about that, you can do 16 to 32 hours at the time. I wasn't part-time, but then it was very challenging being a new mother and breastfeeding and all that. So I decided to cut down the hours to part-time. In the meantime, you know, we're trying to figure out a solution. The Buffalo office ended up putting in for a specialty transfer for Arabic-speaking agents, open to the whole bureau, because everybody needed Arabic-speaking agents at that time. And I was lucky enough to get selected for that, and that's how I got transferred to the Rochester office. And also my ex-husband, you know, could get the job that he wanted there. So, and his family, he's from there. That's why he wanted to move there.
Mm-hmm. It's great that the FBI was there, you know, to help you get closer. You know, you have a child and it does have the opportunities, right? We talked about the language, and now you mentioned the opportunity to work part-time if you need to. And of course, later on, take a leave of absence if needed. So when you're transferred to Rochester, do you still work CT?
Yes. Pretty much my whole career, I was on a joint terrorism task force. So I was in the Rochester office, had a whole joint terrorism task force as well. It's part of the Buffalo you know, as a resident agency.
How did the work compare Rochester to Boston?
Well, of course, it's a little bit slower in a smaller office like that. There's more opportunities there to help the other squads with, you know, their searches and cases. But we did stay really busy because pretty close to that time, there was a Lackawanna 6 investigation. There was quite a bit of overlap in Rochester. And there was a, you know, there was a lot. Actually, for a little town like Rochester, you'd be surprised pretty much anywhere. There's kind of a lot going on. And the thing about CT is, like, you don't know what's in the hearts and minds of people. Mm-hmm. And so if somebody complains to you that so-and-so is a terrorist, or so-and-so is talking to somebody that you know has propensities for terrorism, and you have to look into them. But they might not necessarily be a terrorist, but you have to look at every single thing because somebody complained, or maybe they're close with somebody. And even that closeness doesn't mean anything sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they don't even know what the other person might have been planning. So it's not quite black and white like maybe some of the criminal cases. Mm-hmm. Takes some patience and some, you know, at least you have a lot of tools available. And then the Joint Terrorism Task Force concept, of course, is really great, where you can use other agencies. Like maybe you don't have quite any charges, but they're here illegally. So immigration is going to help, you know, disrupt that one mm-hmm. for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like you just said, right, CT is such a hard violation to work, because unless they're out there clearly building bombs and they have sworn their allegiance to ISIS, Al-Qaeda, or whatever it is, it's really hard to what's really in their mind, right? Are they mobilizers? Are they just talkers? Are there people in their basement? And it's a lot of work. We know this. The CT practitioners, right? It's not as easy as it looks in the movies or shows when it comes to CT matters.
And they, as you know, they take a long time. Mm-hmm. Some of those investigations do. And in fact, I started one in Boston, and I was like, this guy is bad. I'm like, I'm telling you, he's bad. And I sent it to another office where he was living at the time, but he had a connection to my person. And they were like, no, he's fine. We've talked to him. I was like, no. And I wrote like this whole thing. I was like, I'm just going to open it here then. And being a new agent, I was like, I'm just going to open it here. And my supervisor was like, no, we can't do that, you know, Jen. So write it up. We'll send it there. And then it was in 2009 when I was moving to Las Vegas, I heard a news, like it was announced on the news that he and his whole entourage had been arrested for planning terrorist something bad. So
they finally opened it.
They opened it, and I guess they had been working it for years, probably. At that, you know, you just never know.
Wow. You kind of reminded me of myself, because I would be like, my first subject had a lot of tentacles here. I was in Puerto Rico, and she had tentacles here in the mainland, right? And I would write WFL, Florida, whatever it was. Hey, my person's chatting with yours. Take a look. Yeah, whatever. They're doing nothing. It's whatever. And I'm like, no. And then I would document it on my side. In case something happens, I was fully explicit with this lead. Why, when, where, what, whatever, right? Because there were many offices that would be like, yeah, this is not important. It's not a priority. And I learned to make a point of making phone calls. I would get on the phone and call. And at one point, I would never call the SSAs, right? I would call the agents. And if I needed to have my SSA, I would talk to my SSA and explain to him why we needed this an action. It wasn't just an information, what is it? For information only lead. It wasn't right. One of those. And the discretionary action, sometimes I'm like, no, take action. Don't take it as discretionary.
Yeah, don't be afraid to use the phone, kids.
Yeah.
You know, like these days, I don't like to use the phone, but
yeah.
I mean, in the Bureau, I went to like a link system and you can chat on, and that really... I mean, that was a really good tool for me. Like, I'd be like, hey, mm-hmm. you know, did you see that thing I sent you? If you want to talk yeah. to me about it, you know, just, and same thing happened to me, you know, people would hit me up. So,
yeah, I know. And I hate to admit this, but sometimes I would stalk. I'm like, your bubble's green. I know you're there. So did you see my lead?
It's definitely a tool. Useful tool.
Yeah. But no, great job, Jen, because that lead is what initiated your lead, right? That you sent out.
Yeah.
Initiated that investigation and it finally
completed. Somebody listens to you, right?
Yeah. And they follow through. And then, yes, they prevented a terrorist attack, which is just phenomenal, right?
Yes.
So you're in Rochester. You're there when Continental Flight 3407 falls from the sky, and that's 15 years ago, right? And you are honored with an Impact Award for effectively leading hazmat monitoring of that airplane. Can you talk to us about that incident and your efforts?
Yeah, it was really horrible. You know, I was in Rochester and the plane was a commuter flight. It was only like a couple of hour flights. I think it was coming from a different part of New York, maybe. I'm not sure, but there were about 50 people on board. And it went down quite suddenly. They lost control and landed into a house on the ground. And, you know, and everybody on and died. Everybody on board died, and at least one person in the house died. They called out the ERT team, you know, all the local people in Buffalo responded, but they asked us in Rochester to be on standby for maybe the next day. I was on the hazmat team. I went to join the hazmat team in the Boston office and went to the training. It was 2 weeks training for that. So when after I moved to Rochester, I trained with the Buffalo team. And so they asked if I would come out and help monitor the air quality because they had learned, you know, a few lessons from the 9/11 planes that the jet fuel is very toxic. And you know, unfortunately, we're still seeing some agents and support people and, you know, first responders, I guess I should say, you know, dying from that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was just all in my hazmat stuff, breathing, you know, protective gear, I guess, and out there monitoring the air quality because they were pretty much the house was gone and the plane was in kind of nose first into the foundation of this home. And in the basement, there had been all kinds of paint cans and aerosols and then the jet fuel, they couldn't turn off. It was burning for like a couple of days. I think they realized that the natural gas line was kind of still fueling everything too. So when I would see that the air quality was at a dangerous level, I would give everybody a heads up and we'd clear out for a little bit and try to wait for the air to clear. And I did that for a few days in a row. I mean, the people who were the first responders, our ERT team, really had it rough because they had to help process the bodies. And that was definitely not easy mm-hmm. for them. And everybody was already gone by the time I got there. But I know I could see the 1,000-yard stare, you know, and they were so tired. And I'm just glad I was there to be able to support them in some way, you know, mm-hmm. to try to keep them healthy.
Yeah, no, I can't even imagine what it's like to respond to that huge of an event.
I can still smell the smell. I mean, it's got the specific smell of the burning jet fuel. And then, yeah, for a while, I was really pretty afraid to fly on. I mean, I'm not going to lie, but yeah. You have to fly, you know, so being scared, you got to do it. Get back on the horse.
My goodness, tremendous. So I know shortly thereafter you moved to Vegas, right? Why the move?
The move was, that job my ex-husband got, he lost that because the economy was tanking. about 2008, 2009, the housing crisis was going on. And so yeah, he was actively looking for something else, but the Las Vegas office sent out a canvas for a voluntary rotational transfer. They were looking for, 10 to 15 agents to come out there because of the housing crisis out there. Nobody wanted to move there. Mm. Everybody was upside down in their homes. And it was the Las Vegas economy was hit really hard. And I was like, hey, I'm really not liking the cold here. You know, I mean, you've lost your job, unfortunately. What do you think about Las Vegas? Mm-hmm. And he was good with it. And I put in for the job and I got it. And ends up, there was like maybe three other people from my class that ended up there.
Oh my goodness.
On that VRT program. So that was kind of
nice reunion.
Yeah, I got there. One was even on my squad. I got there probably in November of 2009, kind of around Thanksgiving. And I was handed a case right away to work on because they had such a lack of, they didn't have enough people to work. So,
and still CT, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm. JTTF, so, Las Vegas JTTF.
Las Vegas JTTF. So you know most of the JTTFs.
I do know a lot of them.
So now you're in Vegas, continuing to work CT, and you are one of the few agents that I know that received a quality step increase or a QSI. For my listeners who are not familiar with a QSI, this is a within grade increase used to recognize and reward employees who display outstanding performance. So what did you do, Jen, to earn this QSI?
I said when I got to Vegas, I was assigned to a couple of different cases that had been languishing for a while. One case, the one I got the QSI for, but I mean, I started immediately, and that was a joint case with the DEA. It involved three terrorism subjects, too. So there was a lot of stuff going on with that one. But then I was also assigned another case that had been worked on somewhat, but the agent had been transferred. I didn't have anybody to take it for a while. So that involved two brothers who were doing quite a bit of fraud and, you know, suspected of terrorism while I was on my squad. So when I finished with the other case, I really focused on this one for quite a long time. I mean, there was some financial returns that I went through. It wasn't just me. I felt like it was obviously like a big team behind me. We had forensic accountants, our intel analysts, and linguists who helped with other parts of it. So for me, I was looking at, there's so much information. I decided just to start making a spreadsheet. So what they were doing was opening bank accounts all over Las Vegas Valley and in California, like the Long Beach, LA type area, Riverside area, and fake IDs. Mm. And they were check kiting. They were busting out credit cards, but it was always like a different name. But the banks kind of knew who they were because there was always surveillance cameras, and they're like, that's the same guy that did this, and that's the same guy that did this. You know, so I made friends with a lot of bank investigators at that time because they were really happy that we were looking at this case. Mm-hmm. They provided me a lot of good information. We subpoenaed a lot of information, and I just charted it out. I think I had, there were 331 aliases that I found that between the two of them. I charted with a forensic accountant, $5.3 million in losses to the banks. I figured out they were in Long Beach and not Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. Long Beach wasn't interested in taking over the case, so we talked about it. So, but they were okay with me to continue to work on it since we had done so much. And we coordinated with them, with the U.S. Attorney's offices in between the two places, you know, our office and their office, to have a couple of searches done at the residences and arrest warrants for them. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of, there was a lot going on. And even when we got there and we did the arrest, and this was actually a joint case with the Secret Service, we found another reason to they had, of course, a storage unit, you know, that we didn't know about, that we had to go and write another search warrant that day to search the storage unit. And that storage unit contained quite a lot of their fake IDs. So I was glad I didn't have a lot of anything else but their fake IDs. Mm-hmm. So that was a lot of really good evidence.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I didn't expect to get anything. It was a really good case. The whole squad helped. I mean, we all like drove out to Los Angeles area. It's about a 2-3 hour drive. You know, did the search, stayed overnight, did the searches and arrests, and everything was great. And my supervisor put me in for the Citizens Academy Agent of the Year award. And so I was the first one in Las Vegas Agent of the Year because they wanted somebody who worked on terrorism mm-hmm. for that one. And, you know, between that first case that got thrown at me when I first got there and this one right after that, which we wrapped up in about 6 months, you know, after I had languished for a long time.
Yeah.
I guess my supervisor felt like I deserved an award for that. And it was, you know, considered a disruption for terrorism.
Yeah.
And, you know, got to, through interviews, learn a little bit more about what they were doing.
Phenomenal work, Jen. I know how hard those terrorism financing cases are. And it's just amazing, you know, it was there like a cold case. It just needed somebody tenacious and fully committed, right, to work it. And look at you.
Yeah. I mean, my squad mates would be going out to lunch and I'd still be there doing my spreadsheet. And then, you know, I was trying to color code it based on identity and mm-hmm. just to put it in a way that made sense to me. And then I could explain to others. And we had a giant sheet. My IA made this huge role of connections, you know, it was just them connected mm-hmm. to all these identities and, you know, who they really were. And so I definitely, it's definitely a team effort, but I was mm-hmm. honored to get that award. And what happens is, you know, by that time I was a GS-13, I don't know what step, but you go from whatever step you're at to 1310, which is the highest you can get. Mm-hmm. So you're at that pay grade a lot earlier than you would have been. So that's a nice benefit. It's instead of just a cash award or something, it's something that is much better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And well deserved. So 2 years later, let me see, this is 2009 still. Well, I guess 2010. We're now in 2010, right?
2011, I think, is when I made the arrests, or maybe or maybe that's when I got the award. That's when I got the award.
And there's nothing more satisfying than executing an arrest.
They plead guilty, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. But shortly, about a year later, you are promoted to supervisor. Is it of the JTTF or another squad?
Yeah, it was. Actually, when I think about it, what happened was my supervisor ended up stepping down in 2012, and I was the primary relief supervisor.
I see.
And so I ended up, they waited a really long time to post it. So I was acting supervisor for maybe close to a year. And then they finally posted, I got selected for it. So I guess early 2013 is really when I got promoted. And it was for the counterterrorism squad of the JTTF. At that point, they had split into two squads, like the DT and the CT. It might be back together again now, you know, those things always change depending on what's going on. But at the time, they decided to split it, and I had the international terrorism mm-hmm. JTTF portion. We're all in the same area, though.
Yeah. And how long do you do the supervisor position?
Well, the acting part was a year, but then the actual part was maybe 18 months. I had gotten divorced in 2012, and so, you know, it was like a lot of responsibility to be a supervisor of that large of a squad. Mm-hmm. It was a very stressful time for me. Yeah. And there was another VRT transfer. They were looking for a specialty to go to the Columbia division. And I was like, you know, this might be the right time for me to take time out. And from this situation, my ex-husband had moved anyway, so I didn't need to stay in the area for the children to visit him. So I put in for that. It was for a terrorism specialty, and I got assigned to the Greenville resident agency out of the Columbia division. That was August 2014, I guess, is when I transferred there. So it was about 18 months I was an actual supervisor of the JTTF. Maybe 2.5 years while you're acting, you know.
Yeah, it's a long time. And if you think about it, CT is, you know, and this is not to say the other threats are not as important, but when I imagine the tremendous weight that you carry as a supervisor for CT, because lives depend, you know, on your agents doing their work well with the investigations, making sure no leads get put aside, they're all followed through correctly, no bombs go off, nobody dies, right? So it's national security. So it's a tremendous responsibility.
Yes, there's a lot of weight in that. And I had a lot of new agents too. It seemed like we were always like every couple of weeks getting a new agent on my squad and having to get them trained and properly and keep them busy and make sure the work was distributed between the task force officers and the agents. It was a lot of work, and I really enjoyed it. I really loved my squad, and I didn't necessarily want to leave. It was never I wanted to leave the people, but the situation for me, it was going to be better for me as a mother, a single mother, you know, to move closer to where my family was in Florida. I didn't have anybody out that way. So I'm like, at least I felt comfortable knowing they're close by in case I had to go somewhere, they could help me. And also, you know, it wasn't nearly as stressful because it seemed like everybody's bad guy came to Las Vegas. And they're always wanting, you know, hey, could you see where he's going? Or we got this, my guy's meeting with your guy, you know, we need to do something really big in Las Vegas, you know, together. There's a lot of joint operations with other offices quite often. Mm-hmm. So I would say we're really busy. And we had, right when I was leaving, they just had the DT thing that happened out there, the Bundy Ranch.
Oh, yes.
Because that was very stressful for everyone. And a couple of years later, I mean, there was an attack in Las Vegas from the shooting that happened during the concert. So we always felt like Las Vegas, you know, is a prime target.
Mm-hmm. Waiting for something to happen. Trying to prevent something, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, I can imagine. So did you get a little bit of, not downtime, but less dynamic work when you were at the Greenville resident agency?
Yes. The reason they needed a counterterrorism specialty is they really had no one in the field office at all that had a lot of counterterrorism specialties. So they had two people transfer, one to the main office and one to Greenville. I was lucky enough to get Greenville because it was just like, felt like small town, you know, on Main Street kind of thing.
Oh, is it?
But yeah, it was, it's a really cute town in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. It's nice up there. So it's almost in North Carolina.
Okay.
They had a small JTTF there, a number of task force officers, and really no other agents working it. So the task force officers, you know, obviously needed some direction and focus. So the main supervisor for the JTTF was in the main office, which was almost 2 hours away. So they relied on me quite a lot to help focus the task force officers and run cases there. We did have, they had somebody they were worried about when I first moved there who didn't have, and they didn't have anybody that knew how to write, you know, like FISA or I don't know if you say that or not. So we had to, you know, need some experience with some advanced techniques, I guess you could say. like I said, you'd be surprised that terrorism is everywhere. Mm-hmm. So even in small town Greenville, we were really quite busy. And it being a small office, and I was located with the rest of the RA, I did help them a lot with, you know, whatever searches they had or arrests. So that was also nice to do something a little bit different, mm-hmm. you know, to, because sometimes I feel like, you know, I don't have the deep criminal experience that a lot of agents might have, but, mm-hmm. you know, have a little bit.
Yeah. You diversified a little bit.
Terrorism cases can be criminal cases too. Mm-hmm. Like, just like the one I got the award for, we really turned it into a money laundering.
Yeah.
Yeah. Case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you got to find that way to disrupt, right? So if it's through terrorism financing, money laundering, bank fraud, whatever, tax fraud. And you're saying, right, we work with other agencies. So if we can't make the disruption, hand it over to somebody who can, like ICE or...
That's right. I really appreciate all the great partnerships that we have. Mm-hmm.
So talking about partnerships, I know you end up as the liaison, the LNO for CENTCOM and SOCCENT. How do you move from Greenville Resident Agency, CT, to a position as an LNO, which I think it's ideal for you having your Army and officer background?
Yeah, you know, I actually put in for the SOCCENT position and I was not selected. It was the first one that they were having, and I didn't have the background because I didn't have headquarters position at that time. But the CENTCOM LNO had gotten deployment orders. He was in the Marine Reserves. And so he was going down the list of people who applied for the SOCCENT job. It's located on the same base here in Tampa. And he was asking if people wanted to take a TDY for 1 year while he was deployed. Mm-hmm. And for me, I was like, let me just think about it. You know, I'd been in Greenville for a couple of years at that point, two to be exact, and kids were doing good. But my family was in Florida. My dad was in Tampa, mom in Sarasota. I was like, if I take this position, maybe by the time the SOCCENT position rolls around again, you know, it'll give me really good experience to be able to qualify for that job. So I said I would do it, and it was supposed to be TDY for 1 year. And this is, I was a 13 serving as a GS-15, the CENTCOM mm-hmm. position. It ended up being a year and a half because his deployment got extended, and then I had to move back to Greenville.
Oh.
Yeah. But the time when I was at CENTCOM was 2016 to early 2018. It was like August 2016 to February 2018. And this was the height of the ISIS campaign. Mm. Yeah, the Bureau was really looking hard at ISIS. ISIS was all over the place, and that was for CENTCOM, their primary focus. So there was a lot of really good information coming from the Bureau to share with DOD mm-hmm. and vice versa. And there was also a lot of requests for declassification, you know, coming from the Bureau or our partners through the Bureau, or like maybe our foreign partner needed something. So they asked the Bureau through, and then they needed declassification of some materials found on the, you know, battlefield in the past that could help them with their terrorism case. Mm-hmm. You know, so we worked on getting those things declassified okay. for them to help their cases. Mm-hmm. So that was a really interesting time. I was there alone. You're supposed to have an IA as well, but for a while that position was vacant until the very end. They finally got one in. That one, I was also with kind of an interagency group, and I felt right at home because it had Treasury and mm-hmm. Homeland Security, Customs.
Yeah.
So it felt like it was a little JTTF right there. And, you know, we at times had to debrief the four-star general. And we worked a lot with the Washington Field Office because of the good information they had coming in. Mm-hmm. And actually, General Votel ended up writing a letter of commendation for those agents and me on something we worked on regarding the DEISIS campaign.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, great work. I've worked with Soxent, I think I mentioned to you, right? So I've talked to the LNO there, and I thought at one point you and I may have crossed paths, but it's amazing work, and it's important that that role exists, right? Because otherwise there's no way for the military or the FBI to communicate and share information. We have something set up with the other agencies, right? The interagencies, but with them, this is the way to do it. And it's just gives you more experience on different things.
I think it's a very important role. The DOD, LNOs, and they're all over the world because there's combatant commands all over the world, mm-hmm. So there's one at each, and there's one at each special operations command, belonging to that combatant command. So that's what Soxent was, the special operations part of Central Command.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back to Greenville for about a year and a half, and in that time I applied for that Soxent job. And this time I had a lot of really good examples from my 954, mm-hmm. Basically the resume you submit to put in for jobs with the Bureau. And I was selected for that. So I got to move back down to Tampa. I try to pick the same area so my kids could pick up with friends they had made.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I'm not moving until at least my son is out of high school and he's a junior right now.
Yeah.
My daughter is in college.
And you're still in Tampa. So you...
I'm still here.
You ended your career as an LNO for Soxent?
Yeah, that's right. I came up on my 20 years at the same time. It was almost time for me to leave. I might have left a little bit early just to so the other guy could get his orders and get there. But I'd done just about 3 years at Soxent during COVID and everything. And we had a lot of good overlap again with FBI and DOD operations, a little bit different, a little more tactical over there, Special Operations Command, Central, but it was a really good experience and a whole bunch of really great guys doing important things there too.
Yeah, absolutely. So you said you worked CT for the majority of your career, but you still had that diversity. You were in the hazmat team. You worked, your disruptions were criminal based. So you had to work the crim side of into your CT cases. You become a supervisor. You work as an LNO. So you've had a diversity, although CT based, wonderful career. How would you describe your career with the Bureau?
I think it was great. As I reflect back, I did a lot of things I never really expected to do. I feel like I did make an impact on at least the national security of the United States. While my small part, there's so many other people also working, in the Bureau on that, keeping everybody safe.
Mm-hmm.
I got to travel. I went to Rome, went to Dubai a few times, went to Qatar, all on FBI related, either conferences or, cases kind of thing, and to Jerusalem. So I got to see quite a bit and do quite a bit. And I think, you can stay in the same office
mm-hmm.
nowadays for your whole career, which some people do. But I felt like I got to see more of the Bureau. From moving in four different offices and then what we do with DOD, that's a whole different animal that some people don't quite understand, but I think it's very important. And it's kind of like, I feel like a legat because they do speak a different language there, right? Than us, the Bureau speak, and DOD speak is different.
Yeah.
And they have a different culture. Although I was in the Army, I wasn't at a high level like they are at those commands. So it was still having to learn quite a bit.
I had one alibi. So do you think your experience, your military experience before the Bureau helped while you were with Soxent and CENTCOM as an LNO?
I definitely do, you know, because it's kind of like the Arabic thing where you're like, well, when you talk about, I was in the army and, you know, all them are in the army or the Marines or Air Force. It's kind of like a brotherhood, a sisterhood of veterans, you know, mm-hmm. where you feel like you've experienced something similar, maybe not the same, kind of that kind of bonds. And plus, you know, I had some insight into how the military worked, obviously. Mm-hmm. So it definitely helped.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily need to have that background, as long as you have a good understanding of the Bureau
mm-hmm.
And the Bureau's programs, because you have to kind of know who to talk to when something comes up. You never know what you're going to get on any given day in those kind of jobs.
Yeah.
So, but I think it helps. Just
thanks. Yeah. And I think it's also important for people in the Bureau and even outside the Bureau, you know, those who are aspiring to join the Bureau and may have been in the military, that this is an option, right? In your career, this is something that you can do, become a liaison for one of the military components. So many options.
It's highly desirable, so it's very competitive. I mean, when I left, I think there had been 25 people at least to put in for the job. So
like, it's mine.
I think we got a good one. You know, you want to make sure you get somebody good to replace you, that kind
mm-hmm.
of thing.
Yeah, your succession plan, right? So, Jen, you're retired, but I know you still continue to be active in terms of investigations with your own private eye company. And of course, earlier on, I mentioned working for or supporting the Department of Justice EasyTap Empower program and Skull Games. So what can you tell us about your investigations company?
Yeah, so I decided I had looked into jobs in the civilian world and I had a few interviews and nothing was really clicking for me. I was like, you know, maybe I'll just be a PI. And then I found out you have to actually open your own agency if you want to work for yourself. So like, I'll open my own agency then. So that wasn't something I had been planning. You know, I guess if you're retiring, maybe you should have a better plan than me. But I felt like I was good financially for at least a while based on, you know, the pension and the leave buyout. So I had some time. My dad had owned a scuba shop in Tampa. My mom had been a realtor with her own business. And I was like, you know, they're entrepreneurs, really. And so I could do it too. So I figured it out. I did a lot of Googling and YouTubing, and I joined, you know, PI associations so I could learn from other PIs. But it was a little bit of a slow start, but the word gets out that you're out there and get a lot of work from law firms and doing interviewing and other PI work. So I always loved investigations, and I preferred to be the hands-on type of investigator. Even when I was a supervisor, I probably got too involved, but, you know, because it was interesting. There's so much, you know, it's the challenge of figuring out the thing you don't know and what puzzle piece might fit here that you've been missing. So I got some certifications for like certified ethical hacking and, you know, a couple other things after I retired. So I was looking for something to do to challenge my open source intelligence skills. And plus also I had some time to volunteer, which I didn't have a lot in the Bureau. So I heard about Skull Games from another person that attended the PI meetings, actually. She's like, you should try that one. And once I worked with them one time, I was really interested. And what it is they have volunteer open source intelligence analysts, which nobody really, well, there might be a few that hold that title, but they're really people who are interested in open source intelligence and what you can find. And they have, they help to try to fully identify a girl who may be in a trafficking situation. You just know her phone number and escort name and try to fully identify her and who might be trafficking her, and then hand it over to law enforcement, the packages that we put together based on what we find, like in social media, and other open source intelligence, you know, just things you can find on the internet by searching really good. So they're doing a really phenomenal job. They've helped a lot of people. They've helped a lot of survivors join into the games. They call it the games, but Skull Games has to do with head game. It really is a slang for head games. That, you know, there's a pimp that talked about once you kind of have control of the Skull Games of the girl, that you really got them in pocket. So it's a game of manipulation and control that the pimps have over the girls. And so they might not even know they're being trafficked or understand that they're a victim. So they try to, once we know who she is and who he is, they work with law enforcement to offer the victim assistance out of her situation. You know, so I think they're doing really good. Good work.
Yeah, I applaud every organization and individual like yourself volunteering your time for something like that. That's just so pervasive in society, and many people look the other way. And there's so many girls, like you just said, they don't even know they're basically brainwashed, right? Manipulated by them.
They're very young. Yeah, they don't understand.
It's just horrible. And anything that saves the children and their generation, it's just absolutely phenomenal work. So you do that, you do your PI, and you also support ECTAP Empower, which is the International Criminal Investigative Training Program, engaging multinational police women in equality and rights by the Department of State and the Department of Justice. So what can you tell us about that effort?
Well, so far I've only done one thing for them. It's, you know, really part-time, but it's a good program, a great program, really, where the state and State Department and DOJ have paired up to empower women in counterterrorism investigation leadership. Specifically, they're hoping to help them get the training that they need to, maybe in countries where the women don't have as much opportunity for training, and try to not only get the women what they need, but get the men to understand and buy off on it too, is really important. Because if you give a woman training, but they're still not allowed to have a position of leadership, then you haven't really gotten very far. So that's what that program works on. You know, they do symposiums and trainings, and I did get to travel to Asia and it was a really long flight, but it was enjoyable. I mean, I got to speak to a lot of different people, a lot of different women, different police departments, and learn about what they do and the kind of positions that they currently hold and what they would like to be doing, and the kinds of training that they really would like to have in their country. So I think it's an excellent program.
I agree with you. It's good to hear that we are, you know, internally here domestically, we have similar efforts, but that we're also implementing or trying to implement those globally, right? So that it's, I guess, a more holistic change and empowerment, not just American women.
What I was glad to hear was that they were participating in the 30 by 30, where I know police departments all over the U.S. are trying to get their numbers up to 30% as far as women participation goes. And so in some of our partner countries, that's very low, right? It might be 5%, 10%. But they've also, you know, signed their version of an agreement like that, where they hope to get to 30 by 30. So hopefully the Empower program can help them.
Yes, absolutely. When I was in Croatia, I met with a group, and most of them, I have to say, from different countries, only had one, maybe even two female part of their squad or unit, right? So
That's basically what we're looking at. But, you know, I mean, when I first joined the Bureau, there wasn't that many women. There was one lady on my squad who was one of the first women to join the Bureau, 1972, and she was getting ready to retire, but she had been a school teacher and gotten a letter, like a recruitment letter, in her box at school.
Oh my gosh.
Because the bureau used to be all men, right?
Yeah.
So we have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And as long as everyone's buys off on it, mm-hmm. then you can make progress.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned something earlier, you know, about the men needing to be part of this, right? Because if they don't want to promote women, it's going to stay the, what do you call it? The good old boys club, right?
Yeah.
So they have to buy in it. Yeah. They have to be our champions. And
they need the male leaders to buy off on it and implement mm-hmm. The new policies.
Yeah. Yeah.
To allow for the women to promote.
Mm-hmm. So lots to be done, but you're part of it. So it's going to happen.
It's exciting.
Yes, it's exciting work. So Jen, I think I mentioned to you a couple of weeks ago when we chatted that I've received through LinkedIn messages, right, from college students and different young women asking me about joining the Bureau. And two of them happened to be in the military. One of them was inquiring us to, you know, she is in the National Guard and she's got, not the National Guard. She's in the Marine Corps. And when she, when her time is up, basically she wanted to know what kind of job she should do that would make her competitive for the Bureau. So what kind of advice would you give her, being that you were in the military and made it successfully, a successful career with the Bureau?
I'd say, like, if she doesn't have a degree, of course you need that, right? So right now the Bureau, I'm pretty sure, is looking for cybersecurity, anything, sciences, languages. I don't think it really mattered for somebody who'd been in the military. That's really your life experience, your work experience that they're looking at. Because I mean, I had a fine arts degree, right? And it's not that they were interested in. It was my military
mm-hmm.
Career in Arabic language that got me the job in the Bureau. I think the discipline and leadership, really, even if you're lower enlisted, you're going to be in a leadership position at some point over a few people in the military. So everybody gets a shot at that for the most part. I know that they hire a lot of people directly out of the military.
Mm-hmm.
So if you wanted to join, I mean, and you made the qualifications, I would put in for it, and a recruiter will call you if you do meet the qualifications. If you don't quite, then the Bureau has other programs for people, like entry-level programs, mm-hmm. as far as the surveillance squads and the SSTs.
Yeah, the support specialists.
Which is, you know, kind of an entry-level analytical mm-hmm. position. And, so there are jobs like that, and the Bureau likes to hire from their current employees. So I've known quite a lot of agents who started off as a support employee.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't overlook that way in, you know, if you don't quite qualify right away to be an agent.
Yeah. Good advice. Thanks, Jen. Thank you so much for sharing your story. I learned a lot about you, and I'm sure our listeners really enjoyed your story.
Thank you. I'm very honored to have been on your show. It was a lot of fun. Talking to you and getting to know you as well. And
thank you. And hopefully we'll cross paths with ECTAP. Yes.
Yeah.
Keep doing the great work with Skull Games. And of course, wishing you many successes in your private eye company.
Thank you very much.
You just heard from Jen Cormack, who worked for the FBI for 20 years, received a QSI, a quality step increase, for the amazing work she did in Las Vegas. She also received an Impact Award for her efforts as a hazmat lead in 2009 when a Continental Express airplane crashed in a neighborhood near Buffalo, New York. As you heard, Jen is a subject matter expert in counterterrorism. She speaks Arabic. And even now, after she's retired, she continues to serve by working for ECTAP Empower as a consultant and also as an online investigator for Skull Games, which focuses on tracking and finding potential women victims of human trafficking. Jen also has her own PI. I hope you enjoyed her episode. This one closed season 2. If you haven't done so yet, please visit my website, badassinheels.com. Help me grow and help highlight these amazing women by sharing my episodes, by sharing my podcast. Thanks for your support.